This podcast is proudly produced and presented by the Zoomer Podcast Network, home of great podcasts like Marilyn Lightstone Reads, Idea City on the Air, and The Garden Show. The most memorable interviews and listener calls from the week that was on Fight Back with Libby Znaimer. Welcome to the best of Fight Back with Jane Brown.
Good afternoon. Welcome to the Saturday edition of the Best of Fight Back from the week that was. When Seniors Minister Seamus O'Regan was here at the Zoomerplex for the annual general meeting of CARP on February 22nd, he did not give anything away on when the federal pharmacare legislation deal would be reached, saying negotiations were continuing. The next day, we Canadians got the news that an agreement had been brokered. At the moment, the pharmacare bill includes coverage for diabetes medication and birth control free of charge for all Canadians who have a health card. So it currently falls short of a full national pharmacare program. While filling in for Libby on Monday, I was joined by our Zoomer squad to discuss. Anthony Quinn is Chief Membership Officer at CARP, A New Vision of Aging. Bill Van Gorder is CARP's Chief Policy and Chief Operating Officer. And John Wright is Executive Vice President of Maru Public Opinion. I started the conversation by asking John, as a pollster, if we have a handle on how important national pharmacare is for Canadians.
I don't think there's been a lot done on it. I certainly haven't done much on it. I think being seen more or less as a political tool to keep the government alive as opposed to something that the government has wanted to do. The question in my mind is always, you know, what does this do to keep the government in power? Because that's what it wants to do. By coming to an agreement on this, it allows the government to stay in place, allegedly, until October of next year, not this year, but beyond. It also, though, it's interesting, though. I mean, when you take a look at the political landscape nowadays, the other option for the government could have been to say no to this and to then do it on a case-by-case basis. I mean, the only area where they might have been brought down would have been in the budget. But the reality is that whether you're the Liberals or the New Democrats or the Bloc Québécois, you got no reason to go to the polls anytime soon because you'll get wiped out by what the Conservatives are polling on. So it's a bit of a death pact that they already have. So again, whether or not this is going to be worthwhile, whether it gets through the House and then gets approval at the end of the day, I think it's seen more as a political tool than something that is really something that was germane. And the last thing I'd say is that we already have one province who's opted out. I mean, Alberta, without surprise to me anyways, has already declared that it's not going to be part of this. This stuff still has to be dealt with the provinces, and they're complaining in the back rooms that they weren't consulted with in any way, shape, or form. So, yeah, I still think it's got some hurdles to go through before we, you know, break open the champagne and have a sip.
Bill, since you're the policy guy and we look at implementing this national pharmacare program, what could it offer people who are 65 plus in Ontario that they don't already have under the Ontario Drug Benefit Program?
People are saying, we're happy. We're finally going to get national pharmacare. Well, no, we're really not. What they have proposed is there going to be a couple of areas that they're going to cover, diabetes and birth control, certainly well needed. And nobody can say that there shouldn't be equal ability for all Canadians to be able to get those drugs. But it's not national pharmacare. It's not all the drugs. It's nowhere near that. And when you look at what Ontario already covers, it's a very small increase from what's covered now to what would be covered under what appears to be this new suggestion. But as John says, there's no plan yet. There's no detail. And as we've said before, look at the difficulty they're having implementing just one area in the dental coverage, which is not going well. This is a gigantic task to roll out a national pharmacare program, and we're nowhere near it yet.
Anthony, we understand that in addition to contraceptives, the parties considered whether to cover antibiotics, cholesterol medicines, blood pressure meds, psychological medications such as antidepressants. Does this mean that the conversation's been had and there could still be a decision, or these medications would not ultimately be covered?
Who knows what ultimately may be covered, but the fact that they had those discussions and have not announced them means that there's nothing to be expected in anytime soon. There was a deadline set by the NDP for March 1st, and the Liberals have acquiesced to that in some way with two areas that they have both agreed on. So diabetes and contraception, nothing there necessarily for seniors, as it were. The diabetes medications are already covered under the Ontario health plan for seniors. So it's a shot to support lower income Canadians and younger mm-hmm. Canadians.
Anthony Quinn, Chief Membership Officer at CARP, A New Vision of Aging. Bill Van Gorder, CARP's Chief Policy and Chief Operating Officer. And John Wright, Executive Vice President of Maru Public Opinion. This is Zoomer Radio's Best of Fight Back. I'm Jane Brown. Are you among the 84% of Ontario motorists who say they are average or above average drivers? The results of a new Polaris survey also reveal 4 in 10 Ontario drivers rate themselves as above average drivers, with men especially confident in their abilities. To find out more about the survey and whether these stats are reality, I was joined by Sergeant Kerry Schmidt of the OPP Highway Safety Division and Dan Arnold, Chief Strategy Officer of Polaris Strategic Insights. I started by asking Dan what he makes of the findings.
It's an interesting study. We did this because we want to really explore kind of what made people angry on the road. And, you know, the things that topped the list were things that you probably would expect. People talking on their cell phones, people blowing through stop signs. But then we also added this other little, you know, demographic question almost to ask people, you know, do you think you're an above average driver, an average driver, or a below average driver? Only 1% think they're below average. And as you said, most people feel they're above average. And that's not how averages work. So, you know, I think that the risk here is that, you know, people go out on an icy road and they say, well, I know you're supposed to drive slow, but I'm a great driver, so I can just keep speeding along there. And that can lead to problems, obviously.
What do you make of these stats, Kerry Schmidt, Sergeant Schmidt? I mean, you see firsthand what happens when people who think they're above average drive aggressively.
For an average, you need to have people above and below, but no one identifies as below. And yet, as you're driving, I don't want to say who we are in the realm of things, but we see people that we would determine to be below average every time. And why are they always the drivers in front of us? You know, waiting at the red light, not turning, not moving, you know, going much too slow than what we think they should be going, or making far too an aggressive lane change, although that driver may think that they did that safely and, you know, very quickly because they're a good driver. And yet we take that perception and we see that behavior and we say, well, that's a very aggressive, dangerous driver that's putting everybody at risk. And very likely that could very well be the case as well. So, you know, we see these drivers all the time. You know, if you're happen to be running late, you're probably going to be stepping on the gas a little bit more. If you're enjoying a Sunday drive, you know, you're going to be driving, you know, nice and slowly, maybe way below the speed limit, and that may be frustrating someone who is trying to get to work or get someplace when they're running behind schedule, and now they're frustrated by these slow pokes, quote unquote, you know, in front of them. So, you know, we're always judging everyone else. A big truck going up a grade is going slow. Like, why can't you step on the gas? You know, anyone else, you know, why can't we all be on the same wavelength? But of course, we never will be.
Talk to us about the part of your survey which listed the top pet peeves among drivers, Dan.
Yeah, so we tested about a dozen different things and asked people how angry they got when they see other drivers or these things just happening on the road. Topping the list is when you see people that are blowing through stop signs or red lights. That makes 9 in 10 people at least annoyed, including 54% very angry. And people talking on their cell phones was also another one that generated a lot of numbers on that very angry. Close to half of people say they're very angry when they see other people talking on their cell phones. Notably, that is something that it is primarily younger people who admit to doing that on the road. I think it was 1% of seniors who admitted they actually do it, but they do get quite angry by seeing other people do that. And, you know, everything else on this list, it's, you know, what you'd expect. You know, tailgaters, people cutting you off, people who speed up when you try to pass them, people who don't signal when they change lanes. So, you know, a lot of things causing anger out there. Things that were actually lower on the list, and maybe this is a bit surprising, gridlock traffic was low down the list. I think it's largely because if you're stuck in traffic, you know, you don't have one person to blame, whereas if somebody just, like, cuts you off or you see somebody on their phone, you can kind of look over at them and, you know, shake your fist or flip a finger or something like that. It's one person that you kind of see as being responsible, whereas I think people sort of accept traffic as just a reality of life, generally speaking.
Sergeant Schmidt, what makes an average or above average driver?
We're always into different circumstances and different configurations, you know, and it only takes a moment for you to, you know, drift over a lane and maybe you neglect to have that one double check on a lane change or shoulder check, and you start pushing into someone else's path and they panic and honk the horn. Like, okay, you just became a bad driver for one moment. So, you know, how do you qualify that you're a good driver? It's a very subjective idea.
Sergeant Kerry Schmidt of the OPP Highway Safety Division and Dan Arnold, Chief Strategy Officer of Polaris Strategic Insights. You're listening to the best of Fight Back on Zoomer Radio. I'm Jane Brown. Coming up after the break, Doug Ford and like-minded judges, the week at Queen's Park. We discuss next.
You're listening to an exclusive podcast of Fight Back on Zoomer Radio. Heard weekdays from noon to one. Good isn't good enough. Make way for the best of Fight Back with Jane Brown on Zoomer Radio.
Welcome back. Premier Doug Ford seems to be embroiled in yet another controversy. It started a week ago yesterday when the premier was asked about two of his ex-senior staffers who've been appointed to a committee that vets and recommends judges for the Ontario Court of Justice. His response that day was, quote, "We got elected to get like-minded people in appointments. I'm not going to appoint some NDP or some Liberal." Soon after, staff in the Premier's office said the Premier wanted like-minded people selecting judges and not actually like-minded judges. But then on Monday, again on Tuesday, and again on Wednesday, Doug Ford made it clear in the Ontario legislature he wants like-minded judges in the courts. Reaction has been widespread and critical, including from organizations representing lawyers, the Advocates Society and the Criminal Lawyers Association among them. While filling in for Libby on Tuesday, I was joined by our recovering politicians to get their opinions on the situation. Sherry DeNovo is a former Ontario NDP MPP for the riding of Parkdale-High Park. Janet Ecker is a former Ontario PC MPP and finance minister. And George Smitherman is a former Ontario Liberal cabinet minister and deputy premier.
It's evolved over time from an idea in the Peterson days to well entrenched through all the governments since that a variety of perspectives should be brought to bear, and those that are deemed suitable for appointment to these important positions. I think that's been a process that serves us well. And I think that Ontario politicians have been well advised not to be quite so partisan in their outright desires with respect to what the bench looks like. So to me, it's a pretty ugly slide into the American-style politicization of the courts. At the end of the day, politicians can make criticisms without being so clear, let's say, in their mindset of bringing a partisan matter to the issue of who's appointed. I think it's a real mistake on the premier's part.
Janet, what is your take on the process and your thoughts about the situation?
Well, I think you're two things. One, you're seeing a government's frustration with courts in terms of some of the decisions they've been making about who gets in and out on bail. And the premier, I think, has captured, you know, people's frustration out there about what's happening with gun crime and home invasions, et cetera, et cetera. So he's certainly tapped into that frustration that people are seeing. And one of the ways you do that is hopefully to have judges that share your concern. about what is happening out there on the streets, as it were. The other thing is that governments have long appointed judges that they hoped would have philosophical viewpoints similar to theirs. That doesn't mean they tell them how to judge a case. You absolutely do not do that. But having judges that are simpatico with the government of the day, I can't imagine, and I suspect George would say the same, I would be very surprised if Prime Minister Trudeau, given his views on abortion, would appoint a judge who was very much adamantly against abortion. I mean, he just wouldn't do that, and you wouldn't expect him to, because he's got a very strong philosophical belief on that. So it's a judgment call. It is a very risky territory for governments, but at the same time, the government is accountable to the people for what's happening out there in the system, and this is one way that they can exercise that responsibility. The question will be, are those judges going to be competent judges?
So, Sherry, what is your take on how the process works and ultimately whether there is any conflict of interest here on the part of the premier?
I actually served on a committee that looked at some pretty senior civil service appointments in the Ontario government. And, you know, it was an all-party committee, but it was ranked in terms of the votes in the House. So there were more Liberals on it. And I remember one of the Conservatives saying to one of the candidates who was the front runner, saying, you know, are you now or have you ever been a member of the Liberal Party? And of course, everybody laughed on the committee. But what he was doing was actually telling the truth. I think that this was for being honest, because of course this is how senior appointments, they are of course politically tinged. There's no question about it. It's always been the way. Is it right? Absolutely not. I also think that those who protest really, again, to George's point and Janet's too, this doesn't necessarily imply that the judges that they do pick are going to judge in a way always favorable to the government. That's not the case any more than it was for the candidates that we saw and that we vetted, usually unanimously, even though we came from different political backgrounds, because they were simply the best candidates. I hope that the quality of the candidate is also being taken into account, as well as their political background. And I think that's just being realistic.
Sherry DeNovo, former Ontario NDP MPP for the riding of Parkdale-High Park. Janet Ecker, a former Ontario PC MPP and finance minister. And George Smitherman, a former Ontario Liberal cabinet minister and deputy premier. This is Zoomer Radio's Best of Fight Back. I'm Jane Brown. Over the course of a single week, there were two separate incidents captured on video involving Toronto police cruisers putting pedestrians in harm's way. Last Saturday at 8 a.m. at the intersection of Fort York Boulevard and Dan Leckie Way near Bathurst, video shows a police car making a right turn, driving up onto the sidewalk, and hitting a light pole which came down. The officer in the passenger seat suffered minor injuries, but amazingly, no one was injured when the light standard fell. During the week before, video was recorded of a police cruiser colliding with a pedestrian who was trying to cross the street at Liberty and Dufferin. She was okay, but obviously shaken up by the experience. Joining me to discuss, Toronto City Councillor John Burnside, who's a former Toronto police officer, and also a current member of the Toronto Police Services Board. I asked him first if these two incidents are a coincidence or if something else is at play.
Well, I would think it's more of a coincidence. The second incident is the one that I see as more serious, where the officer lost control, mounted the curb, and hit the light pole. But let's be fair, there are over 1,800 police vehicles. Most of them are working 24/7. People are human, they make mistakes. So that's in that incident. The first incident, not to minimize it, and I actually disagree with the way the police actually handled it, but in terms of coming in contact with pedestrians, you can see from the video there was contact, but certainly didn't look like there were any injuries. I think that happens on a daily basis in downtown Toronto. I'm not trying to justify it. I'm just saying it doesn't fall within the classification of a reportable accident. Although that said, I do not like the way the police handled it.
So a police spokesperson said that the officer apologized to the pedestrian. The incident did not meet the definition of a collision under the Highway Traffic Act. But then they later clarified that there had been contact between the cruiser and the individual. Yes.
Yeah, that's right. As I say, for a collision to make it reportable as such, I think that's what they were really referring to, is it a reportable accident or collision? And it didn't fall within that definition. But I think anytime a city vehicle, whether it's a police vehicle, bus or otherwise, when there is contact, I really think the supervisor should be called out, information exchanged, and it formalized, should be formalized at least on that level, if not reported as an accident.
So, Councillor, what process happens now in terms of an investigation with both either incidents? How does that play out, to your knowledge?
Yeah, well, I can't speak for the police. It was a number of years ago that I was an officer myself, but in terms of when there is a departmental collision, which is what that would be called, involving officers from the department, then they do have actual officers from the traffic division investigate it. So it does get elevated to a higher level, at least it used to in my experience. And then, you know, whether charges would be warranted in the second situation, I guess that decision will be made. But I do recall in my time, I was on the service for 10 years, that officers did get charged in certain situations when there were accidents and they were at fault. So for me, it's a matter of the police need to be treated the same as other people. That's not does not mean treated more harshly, but nor does it mean less so. They need to be treated fairly like anyone else would be. And if charges are warranted, then charges should be laid.
Right. But based on the fact that they are in place as part of their job to protect the public, should they not be held to a higher standard?
You know, it's not a situation of use of force or arrest, which is when they really are held to a higher standard. I don't think anywhere in the Highway Traffic Act does it say that they should be held to a higher standard. I mean, in fact, there are a lot of things going on when a police officer is driving. They've got a mobile data terminal. They're responding to radio calls. They've got radios going. So there's a lot going on. And, you know, when you're downtown, it's a busy area. So, no, I don't think that they should necessarily be held to a higher standard, but they should be held to the standard. Mm-hmm. And for me, it's about confidence in the system and the public having confidence that they aren't getting special treatment.
Are either of these incidents something that would come up at a meeting of the Toronto Police Services Board?
They haven't in my experience. We're more in terms of governance. We're not into day-to-day operations. We're in terms of sort of higher, much higher level stuff. Sure, we can ask questions that might be of a concern because we are, at least the three of us who are on the board as council members, we do have those concerns. But, you know, I hate to say it, police do get into accidents. The idea is to make sure there aren't any personal injuries to the officers or the public and to minimize them when they can.
Toronto City Councillor John Burnside, who is a former Toronto police officer and a current member of the Toronto Police Services Board. You're listening to the best of Fight Back on Zoomer Radio. I'm Jane Brown. Still to come, what you had to say about the week that was and the Fight Back Knockout Call of the Week.
You're listening to an exclusive podcast of Fight Back on Zoomer Radio. Heard weekdays from noon to one. Zoomer Radio, pulling no punches with the best of Fight Back with Jane Brown.
Fight Back with Libby Znaimer has the most informed guests on the week's hot topics. And we also rely on you for your valued opinions. Here are some of this week's best calls. Barry in North York called about a friend who's an aggressive driver.
I have a friend of mine who's not. He's actually taken the van that I was in on the corner on two wheels. One time I checked his, on a trip I was on the highway, 150 kilometers an hour. Can you slow down a little bit? I'm going down a hill. I said, well, I even prayed that we would be stopped by the police, unfortunately.
And now, Fight Back's Knockout Call of the Week.
There were a lot of great calls this week, but the winner of the Fight Back Knockout Call of the Week is Walter in Hamilton, who phoned in with his suggestion about how a federal pharmacare plan should be implemented.
If the government was to set up some kind of medical system, coverage of any kind, that they should balliate themselves around each province and territory and cover only the meds that their system doesn't cover, so that, it would fill in the cracks, so to speak, in the medical world for all of us. And I think that's where they should concentrate first.
That does it for today's Best of Fight Back on Zoomer Radio. If you'd like to qualify for the Fight Back Knockout Call of the Week, phone us noon to one weekdays. Or if you have a comment, email us at fightback@zoomer.ca. Follow us on X at Fightback Libby and call our Fightback voicemail anytime at 416-367-9636. I'm Jane Brown. Join me again at the same time tomorrow when we'll round up the rest of the Best of Fight Back.
Best of Fight Back is produced by Jane Brown, Zeev Hadi, and Dan Christakos. Technical production by Ian Robertson. Executive producer, Moses Neimer. This podcast is proudly produced and presented by the Zoomer Podcast Network, home of great podcasts like Marilyn Lightstone Reads, Idea City on the Air, and The Garden Show.